This is one of those days, gang, where we read the economic fine print so you don't have to. It's all about inflation, of course. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. 13 January today, Thursday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Inflation comes to the layperson in two main flavors in this economy. The consumer price index, what you and I pay retail, which we learned yesterday, was up 7% this past December over a year ago. And then the producer price index, wholesale inflation, which the Bureau of Labor Statistics told us this morning was up 9.7% annually. Eric Lund is principal economist at the Conference Board.
The PPI number was actually on a year-on-year basis at a historical high. So, you know, the sort of gut reaction to it is like, oh, goodness, that's pretty bad.
Yes, but.
If you peel the data back a little bit and you look at the month-over-month growth rates, the December reading actually slowed quite a bit relative to November.
Which, if you remember, is exactly what Sabri was telling us yesterday about consumer prices.
A lot of the inflationary momentum, at least on the PPI side of things, seems to be more service-oriented than goods-oriented at the moment.
We are using more services than stuff because, of course, as it has been for a while now, the virus and Omicron.
There's been a lot of disruptions in terms of staffing shortages, a lot of people calling in sick, a lot of people concerned about coming back into the workforce.
Also, though,
wages have been rising really, really fast. That's associated with a rebound in demand for workers and limited supply of workers.
Okay, last word on inflation on the program today, I promise, goes to Lindsay Piegza. She's chief economist at Stifel.
As savings are dwindled, as workers move back into the labor market, as some of that end of the year holiday spending slows, the pressure on producers is likely to abate, at least somewhat.
At least somewhat. So what's the takeaway here? Headline PPI this month was bad. Month-to-month number not so bad. We will talk again next month. Wall Street on this Thursday. Well, there was a little bit of thesaurus, I'll tell you. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. According to the people who keep track of this stuff, that would be the Marine Exchange down at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. We went to see them last month-ish, sometime. There are, as of yesterday, 104 ships stretched out across the near Pacific Ocean waiting for a spot to come in and unload their containers. That is down one from earlier this week, so, you know, still backed up, right? That is a long windup, admittedly, to pointing out that we are going to get December's retail sales numbers tomorrow morning. And the trend of late has been us buying more stuff, lots more stuff, which is, of course, great for retailers. But as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, between Omicron and the supply chain and staffing shortages, getting people the exact items they want, it's not so easy.
Forget fashion rules like classic cuts and basic black. Rachel Lutz says these days, her customers at the Peacock Room, a special occasion clothing store in Detroit, are looking to make a statement.
Instead of, you know, buying a cute pair of sparkly earrings, buying like the biggest tiara that we have. People want color and pattern. And they want happiness.
Money may not buy happiness, but it can buy one-of-a-kind dresses, something Lutz's customers want more of, which puts pressure on her to find special items. And between supply chain issues and labor shortages, that's getting harder to do.
Some of our dress vendors have really cut back on, you know, instead of showing us 200 dresses for the season, they're showing us 40 or 50.
She says sales are strong because people are so eager to shop. But she worries their flexibility when it comes to color or style won't last forever.
There's just no room in the market right now for mediocre. You really have to have great stuff for your customers.
It's the same story over at Gottwalls Books, which has four stores in Middle Georgia. Owner Shane Gottwalls says business has literally never been better. But he's still worried about his biggest competitor, Amazon, because the new releases he orders are showing up weeks late.
we just can't get everything that we know we need to put before them to keep our store super relevant and have the hottest and latest and greatest stuff.
The latest and greatest these days are cookbooks. Apparently, even this far into the pandemic, lots of people are still learning how to bake their own bread. Sales have also been strong at the Brass Owl Boutique in Queens, New York, though owner Nicole Panettiere says they've decreased by 40% this week because of Omicron. But unlike the other business owners in this story, she is much less affected by supply chain problems because the majority of what she sells is made in the U.S.
A huge chunk of that is New York and Queens. And 100% everything going on makes me feel good about the strategy we have.
She hasn't dodged every supply chain bullet, though. This week, she finally got Christmas ornaments that were supposed to arrive last year. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
I want to go back to the December unemployment report for a second. We got it last Friday, talked about it quite a bit with Catherine Rempel and Kate Davidson that day. Mitchell did a story for us, too, you might remember. But there is something we left out that we need to not let slip. The overall unemployment rate did drop to 3.9%. We told you about that. But the unemployment rate for Black women went up from 4.9 to 6.2%, which is a big jump, and it needs some explaining. That's why we've gotten Michelle Holder on the phone. She's long been a scholar of Black women in the American labor force. She's also the president and the CEO of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Michelle, welcome to the program. It's great to have you back on.
It's great to be with you again, Kai. Thank you.
Jobs report comes out last Friday. You, as an interested observer and all the rest of us, grabbed it hot off the presses at 8:30. What did you think when you scrolled down to the part where it gets broken out by race and gender?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that's been pretty clear over the course of this COVID pandemic is that the participation rate of Black women in the U.S. labor force has been on the steepest decline, with the exception of Latinas. The biggest drop in the labor force participation rate among female demographic groups is among Latinas, and then secondly, Black women. But the magnitude of those declines is really quite telling.
Talk to me a little bit about why it's happening.
Sure. So, you know, in looking at Black women, part of the story there is, like all women in the U.S., they are overrepresented in the service sector. But, you know, they are also particularly overrepresented in the care industry. And the most likely jobs to be lost during the first several months of the COVID downturn were as cashiers first, and then secondly, as childcare workers. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the things that really played into the steep decline in Black women's labor force participation rate, their overrepresentation in the care industry in the U.S.
Okay, so now move from the kinds of jobs that Black women do in this economy to the position Black women hold in the American labor force, because they are unique, right? Both in their status in households and in how they bring home the wages in those households.
Absolutely. So, you know, one thing I would definitely want to sort of preface this discussion by saying is that Black women are actually the most attached to the labor force, more so than white women, more so than Latinas. There are reasons for that. One major one is that, you know, after emancipation, Black men's wages was so little that it was actually necessary for Black women to work. But, you know, fast forward to the present day, you know, the position of Black women in the workforce, it's determined by several things. You know, number one, a really pivotal moment in the history of the United States was the Civil Rights Act, because prior to that, there were occupations and industries that Black women were actively excluded from. You know, that period kind of cast a shadow on where Black women would be situated in the workforce in this country for decades to come.
So what does it mean now, decades later, right? As we sit here looking at a December 2021 unemployment report, and the unemployment rate for Black women goes up by something like 1.5% as the overall rate goes down, and everybody says, ooh, look, full employment practically. What does that mean for the broader economy?
It doesn't mean anything good. Sure. If you look carefully at the numbers, what effectively happened is Black women started re-engaging more so in terms of looking for work, but could not find work. And furthermore, you know, even though their labor force participation rate, along with basically every other demographic groups, increased slightly, we're on a downward trajectory in right. terms of disattachment to the American labor force, which is really not good for our economy at all.
So as we enter year three of this pandemic, with all of the historical situations that you have cited and a future as uncertain in this economy as it's been in many a decade, yeah. where are we going, do you think? What's your guess?
Yeah, it's difficult to really say with accuracy, of course. And, you know, as an economist, I always try to avoid sort of predicting what's going to happen in the future because we're frequently wrong. We're frequently wrong. But my, so one of the things that I think, unfortunately, we're going to see is more precarity with regard to Black and brown women as workers, simply because if an employer is comparing resumes and for Black and brown women, you're seeing longer stints of unemployment. This has a real, what economists like to call scarring effect. There are going to be lingering scarring effects more so for Black and brown women.
You know, that's so funny because Jay Powell, early on in this pandemic and through the middle phases of it, not that we're out of it, but in the mid ranges of it, he would talk about the scarring effects of this pandemic on the labor force. And here you are now saying it's going to be worse, actually, than we thought.
Well, it's going to be worse for women of color.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the key. That's the key. Mm-hmm.
Michelle Holder is the president and CEO of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Also, because I guess she just needs a lot of stuff to do, she's an associate professor of economics at John Jay College at the City University of New York. Michelle, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you as well, Kai. Take care.
Coming up,
it's succeeded as a meme, no question.
The future, perhaps, of the internet. But first, let's do the numbers. Who are the Wawas? Did not expect the Wawas today. There you go. I control nothing around here. Dow Industrials down 176, about 0.5%. Closed at 36,113. The NASDAQ, here's where the Wawas come in, down 381 points, about 2.5%, 14,806. S&P 500 down 67 points, 1.4% there. Finished at 46.59. Homebuilder KB Home piled up 16.5% today. Company posted fiscal fourth quarter earnings yesterday that topped expectations, always a plus for traders. D.R. Horton added 0.3%. Bond prices went up. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note down 1.70%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We got first-time claims for unemployment benefits this morning. That, of course, is how you know it's Thursday. They were up a bit, 230,000 new applications last week. Omicron is the culprit, of course. The not-so-new-anymore strain is also behind a lot of the short-term labor squeeze that we are seeing. People staying home because they or someone they are caring for has tested positive. And that includes what is known as the sanitation sector. Public works departments and private garbage disposal companies all over this economy say they are short-staffed, and in some cities, maybe even where you live, that means trash and recycling bins are just sitting out on the curb. Marketplace's Savannah Marr explains.
Tempe, Arizona's solid waste department has been short-staffed for months.
But we experienced another level late December, early January.
Nikki Ripley, Tempe's media relations manager, says Omicron started sending workers home. Some trash and a lot of recycling wasn't getting picked up. Now, workers are returning from quarantine, and the city has approved a salary boost to attract new garbage truck drivers.
But it's been an intensive, challenging time.
And not just in Tempe. Residents of Atlanta, Philadelphia, and Miami are among those dealing with collection delays. David Biederman with the Solid Waste Association of North America saw this coming.
The combination of increased residential waste during the holidays and the Omicron variant is a perfect storm for solid waste collection.
He says sanitation is having a hard time hiring. Plus, there's been a sharp increase in household trash.
Because people stopped going to stores and started buying everything on e-commerce.
And while we've come to expect staff shortages at retail stores and restaurants, Biederman says delayed trash collection gets our attention.
When it's not done properly and trash blows all over the street, it immediately affects the quality of life for people in communities.
It also makes sanitation work more visible, says Francis Ryan, a professor of labor studies at Rutgers University.
The COVID crisis has lifted the sanitation worker into the public consciousness. It's seen as vital labor.
Since the pandemic began, Ryan says many sanitation workers have been bargaining for better pay and working conditions. Take San Diego. There, it's a labor strike, not Omicron, behind the current trash collection backlog. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
This next story comes with the standard investing caveat. Past performance is no guarantee of future returns. And now with that out of the way, here is the item. The first big initial public offering of 2022 started trading today. The private equity firm TPG went public and raised about $1 billion. Last year, and I get it if this got by you, what with everything, but 2021 was an IPO-palooza with a record number of companies raising a record amount of capital. But new listings may not be quite as welcome this year, and as Marketplace's Matt Levin reports, that could have ripples way, way, way beyond Wall Street.
Okay, so there's the obvious people you expect to be bummed out if the IPO market stinks. Venture capitalists who make lots of money when startups go public, the investment bankers who make lots of money helping them, maybe CEOs who really love ringing bells in front of crowds. But you know who might not be so bummed out? Big tech.
The less great your IPO might look, the more appealing getting acquired by a massive company can be.
Sarah Kuntz is general partner at the venture capital firm Clio Capital. She says later stage startups may be more inclined to join the Metas and Amazons of the world if public markets aren't so welcoming. And with so much of startup pay tied up in stock options, founders may have to go above and beyond the free kombucha bar to keep staff.
It takes longer to IPO. Founders have to kind of get creative to think about how to keep their employees, you know, well compensated and happy.
An IPO drought taxes more than just Silicon Valley, though. It taxes taxes. Kim Rubin researches public finance at the Tax Policy Center.
But in places that are highly reliant on income tax and that have a lot of IPOs, their revenues can go up and down a lot based on what's going on with IPOs.
California has a multi-billion dollar budget surplus, partly because Bay Area firms like SoFi and Roblox went public last year, launching more employees into higher income brackets. While some state and federal coffers could take a hit, a dull IPO market could help one long-suffering group, first-time home buyers. Barney Hartman Glaser is a finance professor at UCLA.
On the date that the firm that's intending to do an IPO files its intention, we actually see a big increase in house prices.
So fewer IPOs, maybe slightly more affordable homes in places like San Francisco, Austin, and New York. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
going to sound silly, but you know the internet, right? The thing that started back in the day with www and you've got mail and then became Yahoo and then Google and Facebook. And here we are. Well, that was Web 1, and then it became Web 2.0, which you probably heard of. And now we have come to Web 3. That is the word web, by the way, the numeral 3, no space, just so you know. But what is Web 3, the future of networking and the internet as we will eventually come to know it, or is it going to be something else? Kevin Warbeck is at Wharton, where he teaches, among other things, about blockchain, upon which Web 3 relies. And so when we got him on the phone the other day, I asked him, first of all, to do some Web 1 and 2 and Web 3 compare and contrast.
What's interesting, actually, are the similarities, right? Web 1 was about decentralization and open platforms. That was the web. That was what it was all about. Web 2 came along, and it was also in some ways about decentralization and open platforms. Things like blogging and interactive content generation, where anyone could be a publisher online. But both of them wound up being dominated by big platforms and big intermediaries. So the claim is that Web3 is different, that because it's built on blockchain and other kinds of cryptographic foundations, that it in fact will be open and decentralized. Time will tell.
What's it going to look like? How's it going to manifest? It's going to be different than whatever it is we're using today.
A lot of it you won't even see. Because this is about infrastructure. This is about the underlying technology that facilitates all the services you interact with. What might be different is that Web3 is in large part built around cryptocurrencies, these digital assets that you use to pay for things or to get access to things.
How savvy do I have to be a participant in Web3, not even right now, but like in a year?
I don't know about a year, but if Web3 really succeeds, and we really don't know yet whether it will, it's succeeded as a meme, no question. People are talking about it and thinking it's important, no question. But really, there are very few serious, significant use cases of Web3 that are different than what we've seen before. If we get to that point, anyone will have to be able to use it. It simply will not be something for mass adoption if you have to figure out all the complexities of wallets and which blockchain you're going to use, and if you're going to have to worry about the risks that your NFTs are going to get stolen and all things like that.
One of the hallmarks of the internet, as most of us know it and use it today, is the question of regulation, right? And how you keep an eye on and corral, I suppose, some of these big internet companies that have taken charge of Web 2, as we've talked about. Who's going to be in charge of Web 3? Because we're kind of failing at regulating Web 2, and it seems to me the bigger this gets and the more financially oriented it gets, you know, there be dragons.
Oh, absolutely. Regulation is important, and much of the discourse about regulation with regard to blockchain and cryptocurrencies and Web 3 positions regulation as the enemy, that either we're going to have innovation or we're going to have regulation. And the reality is that is not at all necessarily the case. Do we design the regulations for this new Web3 world by appreciating the lessons from the last wave? What did we get right? And we actually got a tremendous amount right about regulating the internet. But what did we get wrong? And we can clearly see with the dominance of these big digital platforms that there were things we did get wrong.
One of the hallmarks, though, of you know, those big digital platforms and most of the internet structure as we know it today is that it's mostly white, mostly men, and mostly privileged people in this society who control. And I guess if we're going to have a system that's going to function for all of society, we got to get all of society on board, right?
Oh, no question. There's a great potential for blockchain and in general and Web3 to be more inclusive because anyone around the world can get access. It doesn't rely on some of the traditional systems and the traditional relationships that are discriminatory often in the real world. But that's not guaranteed. And frankly, what we've seen so far is that cryptocurrency holdings are actually much more concentrated. Mm-hmm. They're much more dominated by big, powerful actors than traditional forms of money. And we're seeing big intermediaries actually forming in the crypto world. So again, regulation can come into play here. It can be something that pushes in favor of true decentralization and true openness and true inclusion.
Kevin Warbeck, he's a professor of legal studies, also business ethics at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, in which nothing makes sense. For one brief moment on this Thursday, the Ford Motor Company had a market capitalization of more than $100 billion, a first for the 117-year-old carmaker, which cranks out, it should be said, 4 million cars a year. You know where I'm going, right? Tesla, which last year built 936,172 cars, has a market cap of better than $1 trillion. You want to know why I make fun of market cap all the time? This is why. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context. It's yesterday, technically. I missed it, which is my bad. I'm sorry. The Beige Book was out on Wednesday, the Federal Reserve's regional look at the American economy. Here is my favorite item. In Kansas City's region, the Kansas City Fed, to find workers, businesses are doing things like no meeting Wednesdays, yes, also subsidized pet care. I need to have a chat with my bosses, that's all I'm saying. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, and Diantha Parker are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.